Good morning. This is Jeff Blankfort. Welcome you to the June 19th, 2013 edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that usually comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. This month, however, Joy LeClaire and I have traded weeks. Her forthright radio, normally heard at this time, will be back on these airwaves next Wednesday, June 26th. Today, you'll be sharing the hour with me and my guest, Napoleon Gomez Urrutia, head of the Mexican Mine Workers Union, who will be calling me from Canada, where he currently lives in exile at 20 minutes past the hour. Why he currently lives in Canada and still, leads a union in Mexico, why he currently lives in Canada and still leads a union in Mexico is part of the amazing story he has put together in a memoir, Collapse of Dignity, the story of a mining tragedy and the fight against greed and corruption in Mexico, published earlier this year. Apart from China, to whom this country is well over $1 trillion in debt, and without whose construction materials, the building industry could not survive a day, Mexico is our most important ally. You wouldn't know it from the immigration debates on Capitol Hill, the xenophobic statements by European Americans about the sanctity of our southern border, or the way Mexico is usually treated in the mainstream media. Every day, the U.S. imports over 1 million barrels of oil from Mexico, putting it only behind Canada and Saudi Arabia in that regard, and it exports over 500,000 barrels of liquid natural gas to Mexico, making it the largest purchaser of that product. Over 23 million men and women of Mexican heritage are now working in the United States, many in the most menial, low-paying jobs. And Mexican Americans are far and away the most rapidly expanding population in California, with over 11.5 million in the last census. That's one of the ironies of history, given that until the middle of the 19th century, California and the entire American Southwest, starting with Texas, were part of Mexico. They were stolen as the spoils of the unprovoked war President James Polk launched on our southern neighbor in 1846 in order, Americans were told, to fulfill America's manifest destiny. It was a forerunner of how the Zionists, a few decades later, would begin their takeover of Palestine. The taking of the Southwest was the greatest theft of land in modern history, but no one in Washington has ever stopped to apologize. Henry David Thoreau went to jail rather than pay taxes to support the war. A young congressman from Illinois, name of Abe Lincoln, gave up his House seat protesting it, and 200 Irish-American soldiers, seeing the war's injustice, formed the St. Patrick's Battalion and fought on the Mexican side. But this is modern Mexico we'll be talking about today, so stay tuned. After former President Clinton was recorded last week, accusing Obama of looking like a wuss, a fool, and lame for not doing more to influence events in Syria, the White House responded by announcing that the U.S. will begin sending light arms to the Syrian opposition, although what exactly beyond anti-tank weapons was not specified. At the same time, the U.S. is creeping ever closer to using fighter jets currently involved in exercises over Jordan to establish a no-fly zone over Syria similar to the one which is used over Libya to destroy Gaddafi's Air Force and air defense installations. Libya, however, did not have what are assumed to be Syria's superior Russian-made anti-aircraft capabilities. In other words, given the power of the hawks in Washington and Obama's lack of a backbone, we will be looking at yet another Middle East war and the dissolution of the Syrian state, conceivably. The pretext for Obama's change in policy is Syria's crossing of his quote-unquote red line and suspected use of chemical weapons. Allegations of their use have been circulating for weeks, but until now Obama's position was that it was not clear who was using chemical weapons or where, and that the amounts of such usage have been small. Now, the U.S. declaration puts the blame completely on Assad and that Obama's red line has been crossed. There seems to be two obvious reasons for the change in attitude apart from Clinton's questioning of Obama's manhood. The first is the escalation in the fighting within Syria of Hezbollah, Israel and the Israel lobby's most despised and feared enemy, and secondly, the military advances which Assad has made in recent weeks against the badly divided opposition forces. The Obama administration and the war hawks in Washington are the ultimate hypocrites in even raising the issue of chemical weapons, given the extensive use of napalm and white phosphorus by American forces in Vietnam, two chemical weapons designed to burn the skin off their victims. Writing in Sunday's Independent, veteran British journalist Robert Fisk notes that, quote, Washington's decision to arm Syria's Sunni Muslim rebels has plunged America into the great Sunni-Shia conflict of the Islamic Middle East, entering a struggle that now dwarfs the Arab revolutions which overthrew dictatorships across the region. For the first time, he writes, all of America's friends, quote unquote, in the region are Sunni Muslims and all its enemies are Shiites. Breaking all President Barack Obama's rules of engagement, the U.S. is now fully engaged on the side of armed groups, which include the most extreme Sunni Islamic extremist movements in the Middle East. End quote. If it were not Robert Fisk, who's a friend, and for whom I have the greatest respect, writing the next lines, I wouldn't have bothered with them. So I take it seriously when he writes that, quote, the Independent on Sunday has learned that a military decision has been taken in Iran, even before last week's presidential election, to send a first contingent of 4,000 Iranian Revolutionary Guards to Syria to support President Bashar al-Assad's forces against the larger Sunni rebellion. Iran is now fully committed to preserving Assad's regime, according to pro-Iranian sources, says Fisk, which have been deeply involved in the Islamic Republic's security, even to the extent of proposing to open up a new Syrian front on the Golan Heights against Israel. In years to come, Robert Fisk writes, historians will ask how America, after its defeat in Iraq and its humiliating withdrawal from Afghanistan scheduled for 2014, could have so blithely aligned itself with one side in a titanic Islamic struggle stretching back to the 7th century death of the Prophet Muhammad. The profound effects of this great schism between Sunnis, who believe the father of Muhammad's wife was a new caliph for the Muslim world, and Shias, who regard his son-in-law Ali as his rightful successor, continue across the region to this day. A 17th-century Archbishop of Canterbury, George Abbott, Fisk adds, compared the Muslim conflict to that between the Papists and the Protestants, end quote. Well, the result of the presidential election in Iran did not sit well with Israeli officials or its American agents, who openly preferred Ahmadinejad, who one president of AIPAC once described as, quote, the gift that keeps on giving. Today, Israel bids a sad farewell to Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, that unexpected asset to Israeli public diplomacy, who served it so well during his 8 years as president of Iran, writes Amos Harel in Haaretz. Although Ahmadinejad didn't have much of a role in the formation of Iran's nuclear policy, as he himself recently admitted, his somewhat grotesque figure, says Harel, and his hallucinatory statements made it easier for Israel to illustrate the danger inherent in the possibility that the extremist Ayatollah regime could get its hands on weapons of mass destruction. Ahmadinejad's designated successor, Hassan Rouhani, who is a surprise victor in this weekend's presidential election, is a different story entirely, notes Harel. Rouhani's election is good news for the Iranian people, he opines. It remains to be seen whether it will be also good news for Israel. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu can't be very happy, he continues, with Rouhani as a new face of Iran, someone who's more moderate, wants the international sanctions removed, and who won't get caught up in the Holocaust denial demagoguery so favored by his predecessor. Netanyahu will have a hard time convincing the world that his plan to attack Iran's nuclear facilities is necessary, end quote. Those are the comments of Amos Harel in Haaretz on Sunday. New York Times columnist Tom Friedman was invited by Al Jazeera's Mehdi Hassan to go head-to-head on the question of whether the U.S. was a force for good in the world last Friday. The site was the Oxford University. For regular listeners' takes on the world, what Friedman had to say about AIPAC and the Israel lobby will come as no surprise. That Friedman said it so openly, going further than he has in any of his columns, is what is important. This short clip I'm going to play of their conversation will explain the two items that will come afterward. It deals with, of course, with
America's blind support, some would say, for the state of Israel. And you've written on this subject before. You would accept, I hope, that the United States is not an honest broker in the Middle East.
Let me put it in my terms, not yours.
dishonest. Let's go inside American politics for a second. What happened, and as you know, President Bush the first stood outside the White House one day and said, "I'm one lonely man standing up against the Israel lobby." You know, what happened as a result of that, Mehdi, is that Republicans post Bush one and manifested most in his son Bush two took a strategic decision: they will never be out pro-Israel again. That, they believe, cost them electorally a lot. So that pulled the American spectrum to the right. And it created an arms race with the Democrats over who could be more pro-Israel. Then we had the Citizens United case in the Supreme Court that basically said unlimited campaign donations. Now, what that meant is it gave enormous power, I've written all this, you know, in my column, to the Israel lobby. Why? Because, Mehdi, if you and I are running for Congress from the same district, and I have APAC stamp of approval and you don't, I will maybe have to make 3 phone calls, and I can raise my whole, I'm exaggerating, but I don't have to make many phone calls to get all the money I need to run against you. You will have to make 50,000 phone calls.
In that clip, Friedman referred to the unprecedented step taken by George Bush Sr. in 1991 when he faced down APAC over Israel's demand for $10 billion in loan guarantees at a time when the U.S. economy was in the doldrums and he was trying to kickstart an Arab-Israeli peace conference in Madrid. Realizing that APAC had more than enough votes in both the Senate and House to override his threatened veto, Bush went before the American public on September 12, 1991, to make his case. That included telling Americans how much each Israeli man, woman, and child was getting in U.S. tax dollars that year. With the polls, when the polls showing that up to 85% of the public approved his stand against the loan guarantees, AIPAC and his lackeys in Congress, Republicans as well as Democrats, backed off and began to plot Bush's defeat in 1992. It is likely that most of those listening to Friedman at Oxford didn't know that incident very well, since it has been largely buried by the media, alternative as well as mainstream. Their silence also explains why you haven't heard that members of the Israeli occupied Congress are poised to guarantee billions of dollars of loans to Israel right now, so it can purchase even more weapons than it already gets from the U.S. free of charge. And how will these loans be paid back? With further funding from U.S. taxpayers, the way the old loans were paid back before Israel began receiving outright grants, according to Defense News. There used to be a public law, 184, initially sponsored by the late California Senator Alan Cranston, but renewed by Congress every session, which stipulated that the U.S. would appropriate each year enough money to Israel so that it would be able to pay back what it owed for the United States for that year. Try to get a deal like that from your bank. Back in 1991, when Ted Koppel hosted Nightline and the Israelis were trying to get those loan guarantees, Koppel had two guests debating the issue: Stuart Eisenstadt, a former Carter appointee, arguing for the guarantees, and Michigan Democrat David Obey, a rare member of Congress, speaking against them. At one point, Eisenstadt said the Israelis were good for the loans because they had always paid back what they borrowed. "That's because we give them the funds to do it," shot back Obey. Instead of stopping to ask Obey what he meant by that, Koppel quickly went on to the next question. Well, not only is Israel going to get more billions of dollars of war toys, courtesy of the U.S. taxpayer, but the U.S. is also going to spend $25 million building Israel a missile launching base. And the Israelis are angry about it. Not about the funding, but that the news is no longer secret. McClatchy News Service reported 2 weeks ago that Israel's military is fuming over the discovery that Washington had revealed details of the top-secret installation in published bid requests. The Obama administration had promised to build Israel a state-of-the-art facility to house a new ballistic missile defense system, the Arrow 3. As with all Defense Department projects, detailed specifications were made public so the contractors could bid on the project. The specifications included more than 1,000 pages of details on the facility, ranging from the heating and cooling system to the thickness of the walls. Quote, "If an enemy of Israel wanted to launch an attack against a facility, this would give them an easy how-to guide. This type of information is closely guarded, and its release can jeopardize the entire facility," said an Israeli military official who declined to be named. This is more than worrying, it's shocking, he said. Jane's Defense Weekly, which first wrote about the bidding documents, citing them in a story in which it recounted details of the Arrow 3, a defense system designed to intercept ballistic missiles outside the Earth's atmosphere. It is expected to become operational in 2015, according to the story, and reportedly is not only capable of intercepting missiles at a range of up to 1,500 miles, but can also maneuver in midair to chase them. The new facility won't be the first military installation the U.S. government has built in Israel, according to the article. Since 1998, the U.S. has constructed about $500 million in military facilities for the Israeli army. Bet you didn't know that. In addition to bases in southern Israel, including the Nevatim Air Base, the U.S. has built command centers, intelligence offices, and underground hangars to protect Israel's jet aircraft. Last year, U.S. defense contractors began constructing an Air Force base just outside of Tel Aviv, known as Site 9/11, that will cost up to $100 million. Israel's military hasn't revealed the purpose of the site, but it's widely thought that Israel is trying to move some of its military headquarters from high-value real estate in Tel Aviv to the city outskirts, courtesy of the American taxpayers. None of these funds, I should point out, are charged against Israel's annual $3.1 billion military aid grant. Rather, they are considered part of the U.S. defense budget. Does that make you feel any safer?